Hello, everyone, and welcome to Let's Take a Stab at It. I'm your host, John Hoyer, and with me, as always, is...
Jason Bartsch. How you doing, John?
I'm doing great.
It's been a minute.
It has, and we are here with a new mini-series. Slasher films.
Slasher films.
Oh, yeah. You excited?
Oh, I'm very excited. I love slasher films.
Me too. So I was, we were talking about this before we started recording.
We do prepare for these shows, believe it or not.
We do. But we were talking about how slasher films, it's interesting because that's like kind of a subgenre of horror, but also is usually everyone's like entry point into horror.
Right.
You know, when you're younger, you saw Halloween or something that, you know, scared you as a kid. And that's like, oh, that's the start of getting into horror. You know, it's not necessarily like cults or supernatural.
Slasher films are my earliest memory of a film actually scaring me, because it's something very visual that I think anyone at any age really can relate to being afraid of. And, you know, with like cult films, like you said, it's more of a kind of a psychological horror, which you don't really grasp until you're a little older. So
I think it's interesting how, as like slasher films started and developed, that eventually it kind of, there was a formula that was created. Mm-hmm. And then I would say in kind of like from like Scream onward, they were very like very deliberate about messing with the formula or expectations, etc. So you kind of get kind of a weird reaction to like a couple decades of like kind of formulaic ideas and zigging when you think they're going to zag, things like that. So I think that's kind of a cool aspect of it.
I think they certainly did become formulaic there for a little. And then, you know, films like Scream, which we're going to talk about a little later, were a little bit more tongue in cheek and kind of like drawing attention to the fact that there are so many tropes to this genre and it had become so formulaic. But I don't know. I know we've talked about this before, even before the podcast. Like, I think there's kind of a market for like a rebirth of the slasher genre, because or even maybe like a more indie spin on the slasher genre. I know we've had a few over the years, or maybe past couple of decades, but I don't know. I think maybe this podcast is the one that's gonna, you know, get the ball rolling. Who knows?
Let's hope. Well, I would love to have that power. That's what I want.
I'm setting the bar very high for this new miniseries.
But yeah, no, it's interesting how you can kind of see almost, as we'll be talking about later, Peeping Tom is kind of the prototype of what the slasher genre will become. Mm-hmm. And it takes a lot of its cues from the thrillers of the 1950s. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of see like some of like Hitchcock's thrillers and its use of these like dramatic set pieces kind of morph into what we see in Peeping Tom, and then as it goes forward with Psycho and onward.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to see the transformation. And this was my first time watching Peeping Tom, and I think it's a perfect film to start this series.
Thank you. That was my decision.
Oh, yeah. So it was.
Look at me.
So anyway, we've had a couple months off, I guess. We did have a couple specials. We did the Halloween special. We did the Christmas special, and which included the interview with my friend Dylan. And, you know, but we're getting
which
back
you
into
did a
the
good job at, I would say.
Oh, thank you.
I was there. You didn't hear me much, but I was there.
No, it was fun to have him on and chat about his film. And yeah, so what have you been watching recently, John, in the last couple of months? What do you want the people to know about?
I watched a lot of things. I'll just stick to one movie just for the sake of time. So recently, Arrow Films released their new transfer of the movie JSA, Joint Security Area, which is one of the early films of Park Chan-wook. And I guess, I mean, I'm not sure if I was wrong to think this, but I thought it seemed that the movie was kind of like considered like a minor work in his filmography, but I gotta say, I actually think it's one of his best movies. And So I like Park Chan-wook, and I really dig his style, but I also, he has a little bit of that like edgy boy kind of aesthetic where he's really trying to make the viewer go through something when he makes his movies. So Park Chan-wook is a South Korean filmmaker. The movie is about the demilitarized zone between North Korea and South Korea. And there's a murder that takes place in that demilitarized zone. And there's like an independent investigation from, I think people are from Switzerland. And as it goes along, it's kind of, it's like a thriller in that it's revealing what happened that led up to these events. And all the characters are lying about what happened. But what is really great is that it becomes kind of this really interesting movie about characters that are opposite sides of, like, you know, this conflict between the two countries. And it's a nice meditation on friendship and just this kind of appeal to everybody to, you know, it'd be great for these countries to be able to come together again and be able to, you know, people from both sides could interact with each other. And it just, the thing is that while it does have like some of this edgy stuff that you would see in his later movies, there's also like an earnestness about it that I think is, while I do like his work, sometimes it feels a little bit lacking a bit in terms of like emotional resonance beyond just the thriller aspect or like the movie making aspect of it. So
right.
I thought it was fantastic. And Arrow just released a special edition of it, so it looks really nice. And pro tip, even though it's like $30 for the Blu-ray on Amazon, if you get it on iTunes, it's only $8. So
John, does this mean you watch this on the new OLED TV?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So we should have started the episode with this, but John and I just happened to buy pretty much the same TV over Cyber Monday sales, Black Friday sales. So we both splurged for a 65-inch LG OLED, which is a game changer for it home is. Cinema. Just incredible. We're not sponsored by them. We're not sponsored by anyone. And we shout out a lot of cool companies, but
yeah,
I don't know.
I mean, it's especially great because, you know, being in the pandemic and we can't really go to the movie theaters right now, it's like, well, we gotta spice things up a little
bit.
It's
pretty close. From me going from a 32-inch 1080p TV to this, it feels like I'm at the movies. I recently rewatched the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the new 4K version, and it looks just as good, if not better, than I remembered. It was the first time I'd rewatched them since I saw them in theaters, and I did not realize how long ago that actually was. You know, we're coming up on 20 years since the first one, which is insane. But
it's also like rewatching those movies. It's almost like we took for granted just how like epic and big those movies were.
Yeah.
And
they're incredible. I mean, it's a masterpiece easily.
And also like just the, it's weird how like, even though it doesn't seem like that long ago that it came out, but like, even though there's like tons of CGI in those movies, there's a lot of stuff that's shot practically, and like the action scenes are so good.
Oh yeah. The battle, I don't know what it's called. The one in the two towers is like
Helm's Deep.
Yeah. The Helm's Deep battle. It's like one of the most insane like cinematic battles. It has to be. But and they I believe they enhanced some of the CGI, correct? Because some of it looked really polished, more so than it should for being 20 years old.
I think so. I'm not sure exactly exactly what they did, but I know they went through a huge new process to they like did recolor grading and stuff for the 4K HDR stuff. So, which also like, it's pretty incredible that for, you know, iTunes and like these digital, watching something digitally that on a 4K TV, it like still looks incredible.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And you know, like, how do they do it, folks?
I don't know. LG, if you want to reach out, you know, we're all ears. And other exciting podcast news for gearheads out there. I got a new microphone. Woo! So hopefully I no longer sound like I'm speaking to you from a Hot Now drive-thru in 1997. But... yeah, it's time to upgrade. So I have the same mic as John. So I couldn't,
yeah.
I couldn't stand his velvety voice coming through my headphones anymore without being able to replicate it. So.
Well, I'm happy because it doesn't mean I have to put in all this extra effort to edit things
to make things it sound better.
Yeah. So it's easier for me. And anyone who's listened to the podcast knows I'm a lazy man.
Oh man, I like how we're like, oh, like how are your holidays, like what happened, and like all we talk about is like new technology we got.
All right, well, let's move on to Peeping Tom. So interestingly, both Jason and I just watched this movie for the first time. Good news is it's pretty awesome, so yeah, we have a lot to talk about.
Yeah,
but so one thing I think we need to discuss, and I think kind of looking back at some of our earlier episodes, because our series is based on genres, and like those are being kind of like the unifying reasons of why we cover certain movies, I think one of the things we kind of don't discuss quite as much as we should is the filmmakers behind the movies. Mm-hmm. What I want to do is kind of dig in just very briefly, talk about the director of Peeping Tom, Michael Powell. So he is mostly known for working with Emmerich Pressburger, who they were known as the Archers, and they did a bunch of movies mostly in the 40s and 50s. Some of their notable films were The Red Shoes, The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, Black Narcissus, all stone cold classics. So they were known for being very forward thinking in the way that they would use color, very bold Technicolor films. Martin Scorsese was like one of their biggest followers. He, him and the Film Foundation are the reason why most of these movies have like Criterion editions. And like, what was cool was, so basically, Pressburger, he was more so the writer, Powell was the director. They both produced the films. But they were kind of trying to give off this, like, I don't know, brand of sorts of like the Archers. And like that would mean something, that there was a quality to their films. Mm-hmm. So anyway, as I said before, Powell was a huge influence on Scorsese. And interestingly, Scorsese was such a fanboy that when he became a big, important director, somehow eventually his editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, ended up marrying Powell. So, really? Yeah.
Wow.
I don't know what the age difference there was.
Powell had a lot of wives, though, didn't he?
I think. Yeah, he...
She's somewhere in the middle.
he's an odd guy.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll talk more about that later. But yeah, so Scorsese was also one of the reasons that this film, that I guess caused people to re-examine this film a little bit.
Yeah.
And that was what, probably around the 70s or so, maybe, 10 or so years after it came out. Mm-hmm. But it was not well received when it first came out.
Yeah. Right? So it came out in 1960. And while it's considered, one of the Powell's like late masterpieces, at the time, the critics in the United Kingdom hated the film, and it actually was so damaging to Powell's career that he didn't make another movie in the UK after this.
Jeez. And it's one of those interesting films too, that is not only later regarded as a masterpiece after it was originally, blasted, but it also got kind of a cult following. So it was like, sometimes you'll see like a film that has a cult following, but then like some critics still hate it. This one, it's almost like, critics changed their tune. And there were even some critics that readdressed their opinion about it after, some thought down the road.
Which is cool.
Yeah.
Sometimes that the time in which a movie comes out and the way that it's perceived initially, it's kind of in flux. It may not be that way later on. I think it was the filmmaker Brian De Palma was talking about this, how you're kind of mostly being compared to the films at the time and the trends at the time. And then when that changes, your work then gets recontextualized to a different social order.
Right. Things. Which is very interesting. In this film in particular, it was more about the subject matter. I mean, it wasn't so much that, you know, stylistically or filmmaking wise, it was really something that people weren't ready for. It was really just, you know, that people thought it was a snuff film. It was, mm-hmm. you know, voyeuristic. It was pornographic. It was violent. And, you know, I think, and by today's standards, I mean, if you watch it, it's pretty tame.
Yeah.
So
it's funny though, cause it's like, well, we think it does feel tame, and you kind of wonder, like, people got upset about this, but it's also like, well, this was the start of an entire genre of like films, like,
right.
Because of other filmmakers following kind of this formula that in some ways the movie maybe seems less special or groundbreaking because so many other movies did it. But also I think watching it now, I felt it does still hold up as being a quite a special movie.
Yeah.
And I think the main thing, or at least my main takeaway of what seemed to upset people the most, is I think that its use of voyeurism and wanting you to identify of someone who's like a bad person who's murdering people as the protagonist of the story.
Mm-hmm. And Carl Boehm, the lead actor who plays Mark Lewis, who's the main character, he even took some of the responsibility for the film not being well received. He said he thought he may have made the character a little too sympathetic with his performance. And, you know, I guess that sympathy kind of, I guess people took it as kind of condoning his behavior, or, you know, you're supposed to feel bad for him or pity what he's going through.
Well, I think it's also because 1960, it's the start of this transitionary period. I know less about like the British film industry of that time, but like, you know, just from what we know about like the new Hollywood movement kind of came in more around like the mid to late 60s. So like probably if this movie came out like 5-6 years later, I don't think it would have had the same kind of like outrage, because this
You're
is kind
right.
of a, is more of a forward thinking movie where it's, you can have characters that are anti-heroes, bad guys, whatever. And it's more about like, not necessarily that you have to identify with the main character, but at least like find the character interesting and see what their journey is on that, in that film. At the time, people were still kind of seeing things more being, you know, somewhat more safe the way films of the 1950s were, which, but like the 50s era was more the type of time where you would have a film that its subversive nature would be subtext that you would kind of have to interpret, as opposed to something being overtly part of the story. So because this one's a little bit more like overt in like how it's being messing with expectations, the social mores of the time, et cetera, that's, I believe that's kind of why it had such a negative reaction.
We were also talking before the show too about the very deliberate pace of the film, which is something that you we're starting to see more in that time, but you didn't see as often. And, you know, that could have been another reason why the critics weren't really drawn to it as much, you know, because they're, like you were saying, there's kind of a lot of longer scenes that, you know, the director allows to play out as they need. There's not a ton of dialogue in some of them.
And it's a very visually, I know we were talking about how it's not, the more groundbreaking nature of it is based in the story aspect, but like filmmaking wise, beautiful movie.
Yeah. And that's not to say like, you know, the filmmaking wasn't groundbreaking in its own right. I guess more the controversial aspect
exactly.
of it, or why it wasn't accepted. But I guess let's get into the premise, because we've kind of hinted at a lot of it already, but, so Mark Lewis is a loner camera assistant in 1960s London who also moonlights taking risque photographs of women. Mark is also an aspiring filmmaker who's shooting a documentary about fear. Seems pretty cool, right, John? You know, seems like a guy who has multiple side hustles and is very motivated and pursuing his passion. Well, turns out Mark's documentary involves him murdering women and recording their reactions. So... that's more or less the setup of this film. And, you know, the very opening scene, we see him with a camera and he lures a prostitute into a room and, you know, ends up stabbing her and records the whole thing.
Yep.
So,
we kind of were dancing around a little bit about, I mean, I feel like everyone can kind of sense our initial opinions, but you know, I love the movie. It gets at some universal truths, like all film boys are sickos and should never be trusted. Especially if they have a secret project and they won't tell you about it.
Oh.
And yeah. As someone who's been, you know, we've both been to film school,
mm-hmm.
you know, you would think, oh, that's kind of weird. Someone would not tell you what they're working on. That's very common. People yeah. are, yeah, because they're all sickos.
Yeah.
You don't know this, but they are.
And we may or may not have went to school with some people who are kind of like Mark. I don't know.
Yeah.
we might have. Yeah. Filmmakers are a strange breed, man.
It's true. And I think, like, as I, like I mentioned this earlier, but I really like how the film handles voyeurism and compulsion.
Mm.
You can kind of sense his, not that you fully understand it or identify with it as much, but like you can see like how he feels like this compulsion to like do these murders, that he likes to watch people and the way he records these things. It is like a kind of like the dark side or like the underbelly of like filmmaking and mm-hmm. like the way filmmakers see things because yeah. they're sickos, as I said.
Yep. Yeah. So it's not just about Mark's voyeurism. It's also kind of a statement about how the filmmaker is very voyeuristic in how he tells a story. And, mm-hmm. you know,
and we are the audience. We're sickos. Cause we like watching.
Yeah. Cause we like watching
get killed.
So a little backstory about the director, Michael Powell. Apparently the consensus was among the cast and critics is that he may have over-identified with the film a little bit. So essentially he actually plays a role in the film. He plays Mark's father. And we find out over the course of the film that Mark's father used to do psychological experiments on him as a young boy. So he would basically mm-hmm. subject him to fear, try to scare him, and then try to analyze his reaction. And this kind of went on for most of his life. And his father was a renowned psychologist, apparently. But you can tell pretty quickly that he probably took these experiments a little too far. And another interesting fact is Michael Powell's real life son played young Mark in the movie, which I thought was interesting. So apparently, like, according to his son, I think his name's Columba or something. The act of making the film was in itself pretty traumatizing, I think. So I don't know. There are some, I guess, interesting parallels you could draw with the director and, you know, the film. But I mean, that's what the consensus seemed to be, is he may have over-identified.
There was a quote of Scorsese basically saying, all you need to know about filmmaking is in the movies 8 and a Half and Peeping Tom.
Hmm.
And that like all of kind of the positive, like alluring aspects are in like 8 and a Half and, you know, the chaotic nature of it all, blah, blah, blah. And then all of like the dark, seedy aspects of like all the stuff would be in is in Peeping Tom.
Right. Yeah.
So that's what we're talking about tonight, folks. We're
talking about the dark one. Okay, so early on in the film, we learn a lot about Mark. First of all, the first scene, we see him murder a prostitute, which tells you a lot about a man. Then we also discover he shoots these risque photos on the side, and some guy sells them at a newsstand, which on the corner. And we both had some questions about
which is interesting because it's so like they're so like tight-lipped about stuff, like he's got the photos under the counter like it's a big secret, yet you were saying on the outside of the store you see all these photos.
Yeah,
of,
they're like
risque photos of women and stuff
plastered all over the wall, and maybe they're a little bit more revealing in the ones under the counter, but it's no secret. They're not like, oh, we only sell bubblegum and newspaper here. It's like, I don't know.
Remember the bag that they put the book in or whatever? It didn't say educational books.
Yeah, educational booklets. Yeah, something like that.
That'll fool them.
That's one of Mark's side gigs. And then his main job is a camera assistant on feature films. So, you know, he's the guy that pulls focus, and you'll see him a lot in the film with like a tape measure and, you know, measuring focal distances so he can get the proper focus. But early on in the film, he meets a young woman named Helen who lives in the same building as he does. And she's celebrating her 21st birthday. And
I think it was interesting how the way they meet is because he's staring in her window.
Yeah. So was that was her apartment, right? That wasn't like some common area of
no, that's her apartment.
The building.
That's,
so yeah, he's just peeking
her
in.
Mom's apartment, maybe, I think.
Yeah. But so
it's like everyone scowls at him first, and then she's like, oh, let me invite him to the party.
Yeah. Well, he clearly has like, you know, a reputation there, or at least people have feelings about him, you know, whether they're justified or not. But, you know, people have, it seems like everyone has at least made a snap judgment about Mark at one point or another. So, yeah, Mark's peeking in windows. That's, you know, in my experience, a great way to get invited to parties. If you peek in the windows, if you peek in the windows enough, sooner or later, they're going to say, just come in, please. For the love of God.
That's how you got it invited to all of the Philly parties.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I was never properly invited to a single college party. I peered in a lot of windows. The fraternities loved me.
I'm just like thinking now, like almost like the grade school, like logic of like, almost like if you're a kid and you want a toy, you like, and you know, your parents are going to buy it. You like look really sad by the toy and go, well, maybe some like really nice rich parent will feel bad for me and buy it.
Well,
it's like that, but inviting you to the party, like, oh
yeah. But apparently Mark didn't even want to go to the party.
No.
And he declined the invite and he goes upstairs, and Helen follows him upstairs with a piece of cake. She's just trying to be neighborly. And I think she's a little kind of curious about what this guy's all about.
He's got some Gosling energy. Like in Drive, like I
yeah,
think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That kind of mysterious, silent type. Absolutely. So, so she comes up with the cake, and then he goes into sicko film boy mode and was like, you know, want to see my projector room.
Yeah.
And, then,
well, I'll tell you this. I felt a little certain way about it because I'm like, a cute redhead is like begging you to like show off all your film equipment. I feel attacked.
You wish you had his projector room. Let's be honest. Like that's... So Mark begins to show Helen these film reels from his childhood, and this is when we first learn about Mark's father being this psychologist who, you know, more or less tortured him for the sake of science his whole life. So, and it's very disturbing to see, and Helen is clearly uncomfortable, but still intrigued. Mm-hmm. And it kind of seems like Mark is like oddly proud of the films, or
yeah, it's,
content
it's
with
weird.
Them. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Like it's,
well, he wants to share, I guess, kind of share his experience or whatever.
Do you think he's looking for her to maybe provide validation that this wasn't as weird as he thinks it is? Or does he just generally think it was kind of a normal childhood and just wants to share it with somebody?
I'm not sure, actually, because it can go a few ways there, because it's a little bit vague, his intentions with it. Because it seems like he didn't want to show it to her at first. She begs him and says, it'll be my birthday present. And he's like, all right, well, here's where I've been tortured as a child. My father threw a lizard on there and it's chasing me. I'm scared.
Yeah. And there's
shines a light in my eyes when I'm sleeping.
There's cool a bunch stuff. There's weirder stuff too throughout the film. It's like his father records his last interaction with his dying mother, and, you know, just weird.
So bizarre.
Yeah. Weird occurrences like that.
But it's getting back to it, it's interesting when he shows it to her, like she's repulsed but intrigued. And I feel like I think that's kind of just how we as the audience are kind of supposed to, I think, interpret Mark as a character. We're repulsed by just what he did. He just killed a prostitute. And then we're intrigued by he's talking to this girl, Helen, and they're interacting and whatever. And you kind of, it's not like you want him to be like, I don't know, you're not yelling for her to get to the door, get out of there.
Right,
like we're kind of intrigued to see where this goes.
You never really feel like she's in danger like that, because it's a different, you know, in his murders, they're clearly pretty premeditated, I would say, and he kind of sets the scene. And in this interaction, he's more caught off guard by her.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great way to point that out. Yeah.
All right. So we already established Mark is a focus pooler for the film industry. And we talked a little bit about what that is. And we find out a little later on in the film that he is meeting up with one of the stand-ins from the film, whose name is Vivian. And they do these little kind of secret racy shoots after everybody goes home. They use the studio and, you know, take pictures. So it starts out kind of, I guess, innocent enough. It seems like they have done this before. You know, she seems pretty comfortable with Mark, or comfortable enough, and he's, you know, setting up lights and getting everything perfect.
Yeah, it's funny because we sense by how long and slow paced the scene is that this is going to be, she's not getting out of this scene alive.
Right.
But because the film doesn't feel like it's in any rush to get to that point, it creates this like massive amount of tension. And like, she's playing jazz music and dancing, and she's like kind of not really worried about what Mark's doing. And, you know, it just kind of just has this foreboding like tension. And he slowly is doing these things that are, I don't know, like that are off-putting.
Yeah.
And just as that goes along, she's kind of like, well, okay, I don't quite get what you want me to do. You're not really explaining things that well.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, just stand there, and puts his camera on a tripod, and he pulls the end out, and then all of a sudden there's a big knife at the end.
Yep.
And then it cuts before we actually see him kill her, but he has her standing in front of a big suitcase. And we're like, okay, we know where this is going. And
Yeah, the setup's interesting because he kind of has her standing in front of this giant open suitcase chest thing that's body sized. Mm-hmm. And he starts talking about trying to get like a look of fear on her face, you know, and then we kind of see some callbacks to the way his, you know, his father would kind of interact with him as a young child. And he's very intrigued by the getting the look of fear on her face. And at first she seems a little kind of confused by the knife on the end of the tripod, but she kind of plays along with it because she thinks he's just trying to get the look that he wants. So,
well, she's like, she correctly assumed, he's a film boy, so he's a sicko. this is what they do. And
it's not out of the ordinary at all. that scene kind of reminds me of the way you described it, like the scene in American Psycho and Patrick Bateman's getting ready to kill Jared Leto's character, and he's like literally like putting on a raincoat and like putting a newspaper on the floor, like all around him. You know, it kind of has that vibe. You know, he's like, he's setting up the perfect shot for her death, and she's just kind of playing along.
Yeah. Oh, it's so, yeah. Oh, that's a good comparison.
One thing that Mark also likes to do, in addition to filming these women being murdered, is he films the investigation as well. He films the police. So he's like sneaking around the next day because he needs to get this footage of them finding the body, and, you know, just the pandemonium that unfolds after the fact.
I thought it was so bold that like he literally takes out his camera before the body is like revealed and found while they're filming.
he's like, get the right shot.
He's a focus puller, and he just walks away and he picks up his camera to like record them, and no one thinks, that's a little weird. How did he know about that? And then like the cops come to question everybody, and no one thinks to say, yeah, you know, obviously the guy who probably did it is the one who knew to film this exact area that they would find the body. He's a mastermind, folks.
He sure is. And another interesting aspect about the film, I would say, is for as, I guess, ostracized as the film was in the, you know, critic community, I guess, mm-hmm. it, you don't see gore. It's not like a gory film.
Mm-hmm.
So and yeah. you never see any of these deaths really on screen. So do you think like in a way they were holding back with that? I mean, and they're like, oh, like, do you think in hindsight, they're like, well, if this film was as hated at the time as it was, maybe I should have just went all out and just made it
yeah.
super gory. Like,
I don't know. I think it's interesting because when something is really well done, like with filmmaking, that you will feel like you've seen more than you actually saw.
Right. Which you do in this film.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know. I just like, I feel like if you were the filmmaker and you made these conscious decisions to not show all this violence, and then people are like, oh, your film was too violent. And it, like, I don't know. It's.
All right, well, I'm going to release the unrated cut.
Yeah, seriously.
All right, so another aspect of the movie is kind of as all this is playing out, we see Helen with her mother. Helen's mother is blind, and you just get a sense throughout some of the scenes that she does not trust this Mark character. So yeah. at first, she's like, he walks weird. I guess he's very, like, quiet the way he walks, so she's like, oh, there's something going on there. He's up to something.
Never trust a quiet walker.
Yeah. He's neither seen nor heard. A real Milford man.
He's a real Milford man.
Arrest development. Anyway. Well, okay, so it's like weird though, because like Helen's mom doesn't trust him. But she's also slightly encouraging for Helen to, yeah, if you want to go hang out with him, you know, go yeah. for it.
So Helen's mom's an interesting character. And we talked about this a little before the show. I don't know. I kind of, she's like a mystery. I kind of wanted a little bit more out of that character.
Yeah. You were saying there was almost like a scene, like it almost feels like a scene or two is missing with her that would really kind of drive home something about her character.
Yeah. That's just how I felt. I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't know. It's weird because I don't fully get her motivation beyond like just the typical like watching out for your daughter. But then also she's like encourages her like, oh, if you want to go up and see him, go ahead. And then I think she's going to get drunk. Like I think that's implied a few times. She's a little bit
a
little bit of a drinker.
So maybe there's something there. There's probably a metaphor in here we got to unpack about, you know, voyeurism, and she's blind, and I don't know. I feel like we're just kind of missing something. Because, like, her being blind almost just feels kind of like an arbitrary plot device at some points, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's an interesting scene later on where Mark is actually watching Vivian's murder, and Helen's mom is there, and Mark discovers that he missed the actual murder, and it's no good.
Yeah, because it's. I think he said the lights turned off.
Yeah,
or something when he did it, so he didn't get the final reaction of her face.
Yeah, and he killed her. Helen's mom can kind of sense that something was not quite right, even though she couldn't see it.
Also, it's just weird that out of all of the odd things that happened in the movie, I for some reason found it like hard to believe that Mark would just be like, "Oh, you're in my dark room." Okay. let me go back to watching my snuff film.
Where were we?
Then he's almost about to kill her because the compulsion of being able to see the shot that he wanted occur didn't happen. So then he's like, oh, lady, stand here. I want to date your daughter, but I'm kind of thinking I'm going to kill you right now. Then he decides against it, you know, obviously. And I think she can sense that he was going to, I don't know, but she's like, don't hang out with my daughter anymore. And if you do, like, we're going to move out.
Yeah.
Well, also before this scene, just to touch on this, Helen and him go on a date and she convinces him to not bring his camera equipment with him. I guess he kind of gets to enjoy a night with her without being like the voyeur. He's actually experiencing, you know, life
right
on his own. And I think that was interesting because he gets a glimpse of what his life could be like outside of this, like almost like self-imposed exile, like from like living that he exists in. And after he like interacts with the mother and she says, stay away from her, he basically listens.
What's your take on it? Do you think he seems kind of drawn to that life? The, you know, what he could have if he, you know, wasn't this kind of crazy guy.
To me, it seemed like before the mother called him out on this and then he almost killed the mother, it seemed like he could go either way on that. Like he could kind of stop doing these like murders and whatnot and maybe see if he could be like a normal human being. And then when she kind of like, there's no reason for her to know that he's a bad guy, but she can just sense he is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's almost like he feels that like that's an innate part of him. It's so obvious that even the blind lady knows that he's a creep who is doing shit, that I think he kind of like doubles down into it and is like, okay, well, let me finish my weirdo documentary.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't, maybe the mom's character kind of represents like the intuition that kind of goes beyond the voyeurism. I don't know. Cause it's like there's so much of the film is about seeing things not only through Mark's perspective, but literally his camera lens. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and she is one character that is a little, finds him a little suspect. And she's like the one character who can't see anything. So,
yeah, that's interesting because she figures him out like pretty quick without any sort of, you know, not the ability to see, but like he has everyone else fooled around him.
Right.
Like all the people on set think he's like a good, you know, he's a decent guy. You know, like the cops even interview him and they think he's an upstanding citizen.
Right.
Until he starts doing weird things and they get alerted to it. But also they're only alerted to him being an odd person because he talks to this therapist and asks the therapist about like being a peeping Tom and how do you fix that? And as it develops, you kind of realize, oh, he did that on purpose to like, cause he knew the therapist would talk to the cops would then be on to him and then they would tail him.
Right.
And then he commits a murder. He talks to the store owner and he's like, hey, I need to, why don't we do another photo shoot soon? He's like, okay. And they go above the, I guess it's like an apartment above the store. So then he goes in there and then he kills her, making sure to film the cops that are standing outside the building watching.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's kind of almost on this like self-destructive streak of like waiting for them to close in on him.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really twisted if you know, stop and think about it. And there's,
yeah.
I don't know. There's parallels, I think, to today's society. You know, I guess a similar equivalent would be how people live stream now. And they're almost the star of their own little show. And they put their own twist on things. And, you know, there's some really disturbing live videos out there because it almost like empowers people. And that's kind of how Mark's character is with this. Like, he's like getting such a rush out of this. Like, the cops are closing in on him. And
so we were talking about this earlier, and I wonder if this is part of it, or maybe I'm just dumb and it's obvious that like, so we were wondering like, what was the point of him showing that footage to Helen? Like, what did he want out of that? And it's like, he wanted to be seen. Mm-hmm. And when the way he's setting up this like ending murder suicide, that it's going to eventually be like, people can see his, like, he was abused by his father and he's going to have this whole like, all this footage and documents of like what he's done, and that they will kind of understand him.
Do you think he despises his father, or do you think he feels like he's carrying on his father's legacy and he's almost going to the extreme, like what his father would have wanted to see him accomplish?
Ooh, I don't know. I don't
feel like he has a lot of resentment, or at least as much resentment as he should towards his father.
Well, but also at the end when he's playing all the audio of him being abused
mm-hmm.
to Helen. It does feel like he, I mean, if it wasn't...
You think he wants to show himself as a victim of all this in the end?
Potentially. I mean, I think he wants to be, I mean, he's a, I don't know. It's, I guess to me, it seems like it's like a bunch of things. It's a, because a lot of it is compulsion. A lot of it is like, he's doing these things because he feels he needs to. There's a lot to it. You know, I think one could interpret that in a number of ways. And that's what makes it such a good movie, is that you can kind of read into it about what you think he wanted from all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, just to circle back on what we were discussing before, you know, I don't really ever feel like he was tempted to break out of this life that he created for himself. I feel like you said, like Helen's character was almost like, you know, validation for him or somebody to just like share it with. And, you know, so that kind of brings us to this final scene then, when the cops are closing in on his apartment. And what I think is the coolest shot of the film is when, before Mark gets back to the apartment, Helen is in his projector room and watching the reel of, well, one of the murders, right? Is it?
I think it was Vivian.
It was Vivian's. And she's watching it, and we just see her reaction the whole time. And I think it's a great performance. It's an awesome shot. You just kind of see her reaction slowly change to horror. It goes from kind of intrigue to confusion to horror, and she kind of like stands up into the shadows, and like, you know, half of her face is in shadows, and then she runs back like behind one of the shelves that, all you know, he keeps all his film on, and we see her like run through, and then as she's about to leave, she just like runs into Mark, and she's face to face with him, and then this sets up our final scene. I think that's a really cool shot.
Oh yeah.
But
There's a lot of shots when he plays stuff on the film projector, where you see like the film projector running, and you see his like eyes looking through the projector.
Yep.
Through the reel. I mean, very interesting shots. But yeah. So as you're saying, the cops show up.
Yeah. So the cops are closing in on him, and then he just kind of gets really excited, like a director that's about to, you know, shoot the last scene of a film, the last scene of his masterpiece, the culmination of years of work. And he says something along the lines of, I've timed this out so many times, or I've planned it so many times, something like that. And he has all these different lights, all these different flashes that go off. And what he essentially does is, at this point in the film, he reveals that every person he has killed in front of a mirror. So basically he attaches a mirror to his camera. So,
and it distorts the face a little bit.
Yeah. Like, all of these, weird. All of these victims can see their own face as they die, basically. So that's revealed here at the end. And what ends up happening is Mark attaches his pointy tripod knife to one of the shelves and puts the mirror on it. And, you know, essentially kills himself at the end as the cops show up.
Yeah, and he gets what his look is on his face as he dies. Yeah. It's a very weird. It's a very like weird scene, because it's like he seems like he maybe doesn't want to go through with it at the end, but then like pushes through.
Yeah, very briefly.
It's very odd.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, he's apparently had it planned out for a while, and I mean, there's no going back for him at this point. Mm-hmm. It's just he has that kind of brief hesitation, I guess. I mean, no matter how many times he's planned it out, I guess you can't ever fake what your look is going to be like right before you die. Mm-hmm. And that is probably what gave him pause, I would imagine. So
there's a truth and honesty to that, I guess. And that's probably kind of what he wanted out of the murders.
Maybe he just wanted to see it for a second too, dwell on it. It's like, I don't know. But yeah, that's the end of the film. And cops come in and Helen's there crying. And yeah, so one thing I do want to touch on is, I know we talked about this a little before the show, is just the aspect of the father being a psychologist. Cause that was something I personally found interesting. And I thought it was a nice backstory and a good motivation for Mark's character. Not so much. You weren't really as excited about that aspect of his backstory.
Well, it's not that I wasn't as excited. I guess it to me, it was like, what I gravitated more towards with the film is its connection to the sense of voyeurism, the way that we as the audience are watching the film and that we're complicit in the way that Mark is complicit, that we enjoy what we're like, in some ways we're enjoying his like the chase of him killing people, because obviously if we didn't like them, if we weren't interested in the movie, we wouldn't be watching it. Right. So like obviously there we're drawn to like these darker elements of darker stories and stuff like that. I mean, there's a whole genre of horror movies about we like to watch, you know, people in peril, and it's kind of pointing out that that's a little bit, you know, odd and weird or whatever, or interesting anyway. So when I guess I kind of almost didn't really feel like we needed much backstory to like Mark.
See, I like the backstory. I think it was good motivation. I do, because if you think about it, what would an alternative be? Like if he was just a crazy guy, we'd kind of be like, well, why is he like this? We'd want to know a little bit more about his past. And I think it's just a great use of mm-hmm. the film reels and just show like showing his past, literally why he is like this. And then, you know, the audience can make their own decision what, like, you know, how sympathetic they are towards him, I guess.
I think maybe more my issue is that I wish it was maybe more one way or the other, like either remove it or I'd like a lot more of it. Like I'd like like just a little bit more detail there then, because as it felt now, I felt it was a little bit, the way psychology is referenced in movies is usually not the most intellectual or whatever.
Yeah, like it can be very superficial and just kind of, it can be used as just a plot device a lot of times.
Yeah, so I guess I would have liked it. Maybe the real answer here is maybe I would have liked it if there was more of it, because I would have liked a little bit more depth to that aspect.
I would be opposed to more, but I also don't have a suggestion on how you know, what I would have liked to see. But I did like, I think it represented this early kind of 1900s, you know, psychological movement pretty well, because around that time, you know, 1920s or so, you know, we were seeing a lot of psychological experiments, and often controversial psychological experiments with children. And, you know, can you implant fear in someone at a young age? And they would do these experiments with babies where they would show them an object and then like, you know, make really loud noises like right next to their ears and, you know, kind of condition them to be afraid of things that really aren't inherently scary, but they're seeing if they could psychologically wire them to feel fear. So, you know, in that regard, I like the psychological aspect. And I mean, to make matters worse, I believe they even say his father was like a renowned psychologist. Like it's not, he wasn't, it's not like after his death, it was like, oh, well, like that was kind of messed up what he did. It was, you know, he was praised for the work he did. So well, I think that if you're Mark, that messes with your head too. It's like, well, he was glorified as this psychologist. So
and that kind of reflects a little bit back to the director, Michael Powell, and his kid being a little bit traumatized from being in the movie. And like Michael Powell is known as like one of the best British filmmakers ever. And, you know, him doing some of that stuff, and he's like, you know what, this movie isn't weird enough, let's go for it. So no, I see your point. What I was saying is more, it's very mild, you know, mild
if you had to nitpick.
It's the definition of a nitpick, I guess, is
okay,
more what I was going for after I stumbled through that.
Well, we'll just edit it to make it sound like I changed your mind, and it'll okay. be cool.
Hey, thanks, Jason. I see it
that way.
What a guy. All right. Well, looking at this, all right, so this is the start of a slasher series. So we don't have other slasher movies that we have reviewed to compare it to for now, but maybe we could just kind of go through, talk very briefly about what are some aspects of this film that feel like the early edition of the slasher genre. I'm not sure if I mentioned it earlier, but just that the opening scene seems like very close to how the opening scene of Halloween starts.
Yeah,
with like a point of view shot following someone, and then
The point of view, absolutely. And even, you know, movies like what was it, the first Friday the 13th, that was like all point of view.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And yeah, I mean, the point of view shot will never not be scary or not be pivotal to slasher films. There's just something about, and it goes back to the whole concept of the mirror. There's just something about seeing someone's reaction when they know, you know, their life could be over at any moment.
So, it's very, it's interesting how the film, it really gets at like just the whole genre, like horror movie genre, before that was even a real, like it was in its infancy back then, you know?
Yeah.
And it like, it understood it better than a lot of movies today in a, you know, in certain ways. And I think that's just, it's just interesting. And like, you know, a lot of people, they like horror movies because it scares you. So you're approaching some human aspect by being like frightened, but also you're in the comfort of your own home. So there's just like, there's a truth to that, I guess.
It's interesting. It's kind of like on a spectrum. It's like the opposite of comedy. Like,
yeah,
you remove the fact that you're not actually in danger. And the feelings you feel are kind of just like what you feel with comedy, but it's just on the, at the other end of that spectrum of feeling almost. But it's just so interesting that a film like Peeping Tom kind of established so many of these very now iconic tropes in this genre. And it was like basically lambasted for it at the time. It's like, thanks for being a pioneer.
The thing is though, like, it's good that like, I haven't really seen too many videos or anything of Michael Powell like in his later years, but I'll say that if I was the director who was proven right by like, I was like, oh, actually this movie was incredible and it predicted all these other future films and blah, 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 I would not let people forget.
I feel like you would almost prefer that to being praised in the moment. Like, you're sitting back 30 years later, like, I told you so. There's like a wall of Oscars behind you, like lifetime achievement awards.
That, yeah, it, like bragging rights are way more important to me. Like all the sicko film boys are like, no, he got it. He understands. And like, yes, thank you. So the question here is, do you think you would survive this killer?
Well, this is a tough one because his victims are only women. He doesn't, he doesn't kill like a single dude. So I feel like it would make me exempt. He wouldn't be that interested. Like, I feel like
but
I have to
also
seduce him first, maybe.
Well, I was going to say, this is also the bit for all of the end of our episode. So so you have to answer it anyway.
I'm trying to get to an answer. I'm going to go with yes. I think I could survive him because I know how these film boys think. And I think I could stay one step ahead. I don't think I would be interested in seeing his screenings. Like if he invited me, I would have an excuse probably. So I don't think I would put myself in danger. Like, hey, do you want to see like my art house film in progress in my dark room instead of going to this party? Like, oh man, sorry. Prior commitment.
I would just be creeped out immediately for like much smaller things. Like we were in film class together and he like wears mittens in class or something. And I'd be like, oh, that guy's weird.
That guy's weird. And then avoid him.
Yeah, I'm not going to talk to that guy.
So you would survive.
I would survive based purely on some sort of like Larry David-esque criticism of him and like, oh, he's weird. He carries a lot of bags around, you know, fuck that guy.
I feel like you wouldn't see him as enough of a threat, which would leave you susceptible. But I feel like you'd somehow like Mr. Magoo your way out of it. Like you're just like late to something and he like loses interest.
Like, well, here's a counterpoint, though. All right. You lose interest. Here's the thing. I definitely would say something in class or around him that would annoy him enough to like, I gotta get him. He insulted me. He didn't like my documentary idea. He said it was, quote, lame.
This is not real enough. Oh man, it takes me back.
Film school. No, it does. Back to film school when I thought that like my short film I was working on was going to get me into Sundance and I was going to be in Hollywood. I'm crying on the inside.
So do we discuss the fact that you still need to finish your film? And I push that fact every so often. I would say like every six months, maybe.
John, finish your film.
I just think you should pick it up as if like no time had passed. Just even recast it, but just like finish the film. And don't.
No. You know what the thing is? I went through the script again.
You're just not connected to it anymore. It's hard to be.
I was like thinking like, oh, I could rewrite it and it would be pretty cool. And then I like went through the script and I was just like, yeah, this sucks. I think I never really read it straight through before when I was in class. So like, I didn't realize that every scene felt very similar, where it's just like the main character complaining the whole time.
Interior dorm room evening.
Remember when I had... All right, folks. I was trying to figure out a way that the character, like main character, would get in like a car accident or something. So like I had him hit a deer, and like to me it was like a placeholder like idea for like later.
So was it really a placeholder? You're like, somebody's gonna know how to help me figure that out. Like there's some old professor in the prop department that has like a fake deer.
Well, it's like, worst comes to worst, I live in an area filled with like just so many deer. I'm like, well, I'm sure there's a carcass somewhere.
Crossed your mind? That was so like,
just throw it. No, I don't know.
That was one of your plans. Well, I remember vibing on this right now. I was so in our senior thesis film class, we were broken up into smaller groups to kind of workshop our scripts, and I happened to be in John's group, and the rest is history. But I remember reading his film before I knew him as well as I do now. And I read the scene about the deer and I was just really impressed because I thought he had in mind how he was going to execute that. And I just like couldn't wait to see how he did that. Cause like when I wrote mine, I wrote it from the perspective of what is realistic for me to do in 3 weeks over winter break, because that's basically when we had to shoot it. And you know, John's got all these special effects, deer carcasses flying around.
Let's break it down a little bit, Jason.
Sure.
So whose short film was finished and whose wasn't?
Mine was finished.
So, you know, this is proof that, folks, you gotta rein in your vision a little bit.
That's the lesson.
Don't be a film boy sicko, okay? Anything else, Jason?
Oh, no, that's as high of a mark as we're going to finish on, I think.
All right, that does it for this week's episode. Please remember to rate, review, and subscribe. And next week, we will be reviewing Psycho.
Dab you later. You know, in my experience, a great way to get invited to parties, if you peek in the windows enough, sooner or later, they're going to say, just come in, please. For the love of God.